Hey everyone, and welcome to the Senegal One Piece podcast. On this episode, we're going to be diving into episodes 511 through 513, which will cover manga chapters 593 through 595. In these episodes, we get to see the rest of the world and their reactions following Luffy's recent appearance in the newspapers. Okay, synopsis. These episodes see what has been going on around the world with everyone's reaction to Luffy's shocking return to Marineford and what it could possibly mean. Additionally, we get to see what everyone is up to as the story gears itself up in preparation for entering the new world part of the Grand Line. Alright, so differences. Much of the events in all three of these episodes have been rearranged pretty dramatically from how they appear in the manga. It doesn't really change too much, they just lump together certain thematic moments more so in line rather than... With the manga, it kind of flows just kind of to build a little bit more suspense, kind of what happened with the last set of episodes as well. I'm not going to necessarily go through and list all of the changes in the order, but that just know that the order that they appear in the anime is vastly different from what is shown in the manga. The biggest change, however, is actually getting to see what happens in Marineford. So first of all, the whole conversation with the two reporters just before Luffy, Rayleigh, and Jinbei arrive is completely filler. And the fact that we actually get to see the entire events of the Marineford bell ringing scene was actually played out in the anime, whereas in the manga, we only get to see like brief shots of this event in two panels as it's being recounted by Brand New in his conference room. And then the last bigger change is the bit where Buggy learns of Luffy's return to Marineford and his connection to Rayleigh is all added for the anime. But it is funny how Buggy imagines that based on the pattern of crazy relatives that Rayleigh could possibly be Luffy's uncle is hilarious though. I did find that scene pretty funny. Okay, so let's get into the episodes themselves. So to start off, we get to see the first part of Rayleigh's suggestion to go back to Marineford. And it seems like this was all a play to get a message out to the crew, like I talked about in the last episode, kind of disguised as a tribute to pay respects to the fallen people of the Paramount War, and specifically probably Ace and Whitebeard. This gets the attention of the Gorosei, of course, and we get a rare appearance from them as they discuss the changing of the tides of the world with the rise of Blackbeard gunning for the vacant Yonko spot left by Whitebeard, which is definitely going to shake the balance of the world. And the Yonko, because up to this point, we've had two relatively good Yonko in Shanks and Whitebeard, and you've got the other half to counter them with Big Mom and Kaido. But now Shanks is really the only one of the four left that would be considered on the benevolent side of things, whereas you've got three unhinged emperors now dominating the Yonko spectrum. And I think the thing that always stands out for me about this conversation is how the Gandhi-looking Gorosei with the sword talks about how the mere mention and knowledge of the people of the D-Clan is problematic. And, like, first off, it's not that they're, like, a secret. Just between Luffy and, you know, his family alone, it makes it very well known already that Garp, Luffy, Ace, and Dragon all being fairly notorious and famous all over the world contain the D initial. And so I don't know why they think that just now that there's more people who know about the D last or the middle name is just all of a sudden problematic. This just seems really weird to me. Like I know why it's problematic, but I just don't understand why all of a sudden it's such a big deal. But I suppose they don't want people getting curious and start digging into what the D-Clan is. They're clearly a threat to the world government and the Gorosei. And I find it very interesting the mere known existence of the D-Clan is a threat to them. As if it's not so much the people themselves, but what they represent, or possibly their ideas and philosophies, is in direct opposition to them. Which makes sense, because it seems like all the D-Clan members strive for some form of freedom, while the Gorosei and the world government are all about control and oppression. We're still given very little to go off of, but these short conversations between the Gorosei are always juicy because it helps understand the wider overall conflict in the story of One Piece and what some of these mysteries, like what the D-Clan is sort of brought up and expanded upon. It's definitely one of the things that hooks you while following One Piece. with all the intrigue and mysteries and theory crafting and all that stuff. Like, you come for the fun characters and adventure, but stay for the gripping mysteries and geopolitics. In the next scene, we get even more of a shakeup with the world order and balance of powers. And it's by this point you really start to get a sense that things in the series were really starting to shift in a huge way, with so many significant changes to the status quo. And this time with the Marines themselves, as we get a scene between Sengoku and a somewhat new character, depending on how tapped into the extra materials you are, with Marine Commander and Chief Kong. And for many of you, this might be your first introduction to this character, but he actually made his canonical debut about a year prior to this in the publishing of the chapter / episode, which was based on the One Piece Strong World movie tie-in comic, Volume 0, Chapter 0, or Episode 0, where we saw at the beginning of that chapter, set 25 years prior to the current day, he was seen ordering Garp not to go after Shiki, as well as refusing a promotion to Admiral yet again. And this is actually part of Garp's character that I haven't really touched on to this point, so I'll circle back to that in a second. But continuing on with Kong, he is a rank even above Sengoku and was the Fleet Admiral during Sengoku and Garp's prime era. And very little is known about this character, as he's only made like 3 appearances in the entire series, even up to where I am at episode 1100. It's unclear what he actually does, since the Fleet Admiral is the one mostly in charge of the military forces. It's not quite clear to me what Kong actually does, other than maybe oversee the Marines as a whole from like a bureaucracy standpoint. I'm not entirely clear. I'm just kind of guessing at this point. It's revealed that both Garp and Sengoku will retire and be relegated to instructors and mentors for the next generation of Marines. But this appointment seems more of a political one, so as to not show a sign that the two most prominent figures aren't just abandoning the Marines after all this and shaking the confidence of the people in the world. There is definitely a bit of a subtext that both Sengoku and Garp have kind of chosen to retire at this moment, not just because the values and ideals of the Marines have changed with this new generation, and that it no longer kind of fits with that what their beliefs are. And this was particularly apparent with how the Marines approached this whole war. And for Garp in particular, it was hard for him to reconcile these changes in values. But you can also almost get a sense that they're a little disappointed, but also kind of have hope for the future of the Marines with the right people, which leads Sengoku to recommend Aokiji as the next Fleet Admiral. Now, this is really interesting because I think Aokiji would make a great Fleet Admiral. He would potentially be able to change the direction of the Marines for the better. We know that he is one of the good Marines that has his own brand of justice that is fair, but we'll see if he can keep that going now that, you know, being at the top is even more restricted in what they can do. And basically, they're direct subordinates to the Celestial Dragons. And this would open up another spot in the Admirals to make way for potentially someone else to take Aokiji's spot, which will be fun to see all these different positions change, like the vacant Yonko spot as well as several Shichibukai spots and the new sort of Marine spots as well. So yeah, it's definitely going to be changing here on out. Now, circling back to Garp and his constant refusal to be promoted, it's founded on the idea that once you become an admiral, your freedoms are vastly restricted in terms of what you can do and who you can help. And instead, you become the lapdogs of the Celestial Dragons, having to do their bidding and not disobey any orders they command. And with Garp being the grandparent of Luffy, this attitude kind of tracks. Despite wanting to follow and enforce the law, he does not want to take away freedoms, especially his own. And this explanation is also explicitly given in Chapter 0 as well. And if you haven't yet, go read or watch Chapter 0 or Episode 0. It's definitely worth it because it does give you a lot of small little characterization moments for a lot of characters in the world of One Piece, particularly on the Marine side, but also some on the pirate side as well, because Chapter 0, like I've mentioned in the past, is also the point where you get to see Roger's execution from different points of view, particularly some of the other more prominent Shichibukai members as well. Also, fun fact, when Sengoku is talking to Kong about Aokiji being a candidate for the next Fleet Admiral, it just randomly cuts to him sneezing. And for many people in the US, this probably doesn't really make much sense unless you watch a lot of anime or Japanese media in general. And you may not have noticed it if you have seen a lot of it, but there's this general Asian superstition. It's not just a Japanese one, but it's a general Asian superstition. But if someone else is talking about you elsewhere in the world, or perhaps even behind your back, it is said that you sneeze because of that. And so often, you know, if you sneeze in Japan, people will be like, oh, someone must be talking about you somewhere. Of course, beyond Aokiji, the person who I and Garp picked to lead the Marines in the future, who will eventually, at least we think, will take this into a positive direction, is the subject of the next scene with Kobe in the hospital recovering from his injuries. And here he's being told that the sensation that he's been experiencing is that he's awakened his haki. And this is the first time that Oda has made it clear that haki can be used to sense things and not just used to imbue attacks with extra power or to kind of overwhelm people with power. And this now draws a fairly decent line to the idea that Aisa, Enel, and his priests were all using this sensing type of haki that now Kobe can also use as well. But it seems like Kobe, Aisa, and Enel, particularly all three of them, even beyond the priests, have this elevated level of haki where they can actually like almost feel the feelings and thoughts of the people around them to a large degree as well. Now, Enel also had the ability to use his electricity to propagate that feeling, sensing even further than both Aisa and Kobe, but both Aisa and Kobe seem to have a pretty powerful ability to use this sensing type of haki. And by this point, you can see Oda really developing and expanding the whole new power system of haki apart from the devil fruits. And with what the doctor tells Kobe and Helmeppo, that everyone who's a vice admiral or above utilizes haki in some form, he starts to get a sense of how people like Garp or Shanks, who don't have a devil fruit power, achieve so much. And it'll be fun to see how this new power system develops as the series goes, because you get the feeling that this is going to be more and more prevalent in the new world, and it's going to be important for Luffy to be able to control his conqueror's haki even more so now. Finally, to round out the developments of the Marines, we get a conversation between Aokiji and Smoker, who we haven't seen in a while. I mean, I guess he showed up in the war, but he barely was there. And Smoker is asking to be transferred to the Marine base G5 in the New World. Despite its unruly reputation, Smoker wants to be stationed there because it's the fact that it's in the New World, so he can continue to pursue Luffy there. And he's still evidently chasing them, even though he hasn't really been seen all that much in the series since Arabasta. And I always kind of hated how sidelined Smoker and Tashigi became throughout this chunk of the series. So I was glad that Oda explicitly set Smoker up to have a larger role in the new world, where, you know, he'll have more interactions with Luffy. But it always struck me as a little weird, because it seems like Smoker kind of fell to the wayside and just becomes almost irrelevant to the story, where he had a really good setup, but he just, by this point, it seems like Oda just doesn't know what to do with Smoker. And unfortunately, it seems like that's kind of the case for the rest of the series, but I don't know. We'll see though. I trust Oda that he's gonna like pull something out of his ass where Smoker plays a huge role later on, because he has been set up in a pretty large way. Episode 511 then also looks at the state of the world from the pirate side of things, with a round robin between all the worst generation pirates, starting with Kid. And a couple things to mention with this scene is first the explanation given by Killer for Luffy ringing the ox bell 16 times. And they're all interpreting that Luffy did this to show as a power play or dominance, and that the new era sort of is his, and he's sort of trying to signify that to the world or something to that effect. But we all know this wasn't Luffy's intent, and it's another subtle clue about what the message that Luffy was trying to send to his nakama was. And this is a very minor thing, but I believe this is the first time we get to hear the first half of the Grand Line officially being referred to as paradise, as in the sense that it's a paradise compared to the dangers of the New World, Which is so funny considering from outside the Grand Line in the East Blue, the Paradise half of the Grand Line was referred to as the Pirate's Graveyard. And that almost seems laughable now. But it's all about perspective for sure. Like, it's clear though that based on Marineford and the war that there are still people who are far, far stronger than we could have ever imagined, even in the Grand Line. But the New World has definitely been teased as something else that we imagine people like Mihawk or the Admirals are like all over the New World. And yeah, so we get to kind of see the horrors of the New World throughout this sort of montage as we hop between the different worst generations. We then get to see something insane as we focus on Gang Bej and his ship as it gets sucked into the sky. Almost like an alien UFO is sucking them up, and it seemingly gets destroyed. And I'm just going to straight up spoil this for you and say that we never learn what the F happened here. And it still bothers me to this day that this moment was never explained, never followed up on, because it just seems so wild that it's just there. In fact, most of the crazy things shown here are merely just to show how insane the New World is. And it doesn't really play much of a role in the future events outside of maybe Basil Hawkins' section. And there is something that, you know, of a follow-up to that scene. But like Uruj's scene where he gets to the island that's raining lightning bolts, that's never followed up on either. And so we get to see all these like crazy cool things, but it's never actually touched upon later in the series. I mean, as far as I know. Now that we've seen many of the Worst Generation and the newer characters, we finally get to see some of our old favorites react to the news as well. But first, we get a funny yet oddly heartwarming reunion between Buggy and his crew. And I will say one thing that I completely forgot here is that we learn the hierarchy of Buggy's top officers. Like, for some reason, up until I rewatched this, I had never even thought about this, and I completely forgot about it, apparently. That Moji is the vice captain of the Buggy Pirates, and Kabaji is the chief of staff. For some reason, I had it in my head that Kabaji was actually second in command, while Moji was third, but it's the other way around, apparently. And I honestly forgot about this until this rewatch, but Buggy also gets a letter from the world government at the end, and I and many people kind of predicted what this letter was, but just in case, I will leave you all in the dark to avoid spoilers if you want to be surprised about what this letter contains. Because we don't find out about this probably for another several episodes. Now the next stop is back to Sabaody, and I think this is a really sweet and really endearing thing that during the Straw Hat's absence, Duval and the Flying Fish Riders, along with Kami, Hachi, Pup-Pug, and Shaki, have all been protecting the Sunny. And it's kind of ironic that they're protecting it from a monkey-looking people. But not just any monkey-looking people, their boss looks exactly like Sun Wukong, which is the main character from the Chinese folktale Journey to the West, and this, I feel like there are many layers to this random inclusion. First off, there are some parallels to both Sun Wukong's character and Luffy himself, in the fact that Luffy's surname is Monkey, but also Sun Wukong was the direct inspiration for Son Goku from Dragon Ball, whose creator, Akira Toriyama, RIP, was a huge influence and idol for Oda. So I feel like there's like multiple different references contained in this weird cameo. Also in this scene, in episode 512 at the 9:46 mark, in the Crunchyroll stream at least, is a very obvious Pandaman sighting on the very far left, where Duval's men are all swooning at Duval's handsomeness, and in the anime, they actually throw in a fourth one on the very far left, whereas in the manga, you actually only see three of them. So Pandaman is not actually present in the manga version, but he is there in the anime. But just when you think the scene's gonna end, a huge twist arises when Kuma appears for some reason. And Shaki kind of hesitantly tells him that everything's okay, that he's on their side. But she's also not quite sure, and it's left a little ambiguous because we, the audience, know that Kuma has lost his consciousness and is basically an unthinking machine. So it's conceivable that he's actually here to take out the Straw Hats and their ship by order of the world government. And so this scene kind of leaves you on a cliffhanger of not being quite sure what Kuma is actually here to do. But we all know that none of these people can take on Kuma, and so it's most likely that Kuma is not there to actually do any harm. also on a side note, there's some funny wordplay here that's kind of lost in translation when it comes to Kuma appearing. So when Kuma does appear, the writer starts screaming, "Kuma has appeared!" And when you say that in Japanese, since Kuma in Japanese is also bear, Dubal is like, when he initially interprets this call, he thinks they're all saying, "A bear has appeared," which is why he goes, "A bear?" And there aren't any bears on this island. And so that's kind of where that joke is because Kuma obviously doesn't mean bear in English. So when you say Kuma has appeared, you just think, oh, Bartholomew Kuma is there, not a bear is here. We then go back even further to Arabasta, where we see Chaka, Pell, Cobra, Inigaram, Karu, and Vivi's reactions. And I always love seeing Vivi. I miss her being in the story. I mean, it's no secret that I love Vivi. And one thing you'll notice about this is that Cobra's voice actor has changed, as the original actor, Iema Tsukayumi, had stepped down from the role. I don't quite know why, but I would assume it was due to his age, as he was around 77 when this episode aired. And he would unfortunately pass away 3 years later at the age of 80. And he is replaced by Toshiya Ueda. And this would actually be the only episode he voices Cobra, which... And Cobra would again be recast in his next appearance much later in the series. Following the Arabasta train, we get to finally see what became of Crocodile after the war, which is probably the character that I was most curious about. Although very brief, we get to see something very interesting that's been building ever since Crocodile's reemergence in the Miss Golden Week cover story. We see Crocodile reading the newspaper and wondering what the heck Luffy's doing, but the real interesting thing is how cryptic the conversation is between Dasbonus and Crocodile. There's definitely long been a discussion about what this conversation meant, because Crocodile responds with, "Is that a sarcastic comment aimed at me?" with Daz's comment that Luffy has a wound and those take a while to heal. Of course, on the surface, you think he's talking about the giant chest wound from Akainu's attack that he sustained, and in turn, he's referring to either Crocodile's face scar or missing hand. But of course, there's quite a bit of subtext with this, and you can interpret this as them kind of talking about more emotional wounds, with Luffy's being the huge amount of emotional trauma that he sustained by failing to save Ace. This combined with Crocodile's earlier comments in episode 487 to Jinbei about, if you want to protect something, do it right. And it starts to paint the picture again of a man that has also experienced great loss of a loved one, along with losing his ambition / dream of becoming the Pirate King that we saw was revealed when Miss Golden Week cast her dream rainbow colors trap in her cover story. We also know from Chapter Zero that Crocodile was present for Roger's execution, which adds to the implication that he was once a young rookie hoping to be the next Pirate King. And these old wounds are probably why he was so irritated by Luffy and kept mocking Luffy for being a naive rookie that needed to be put in his place during the whole Arabasta conflict. And Crocodile says that he's healed, and as proof, he's now ready to go back to the new world, showing that, in a way, he has healed a bit and has grown, and even calling Daz by his actual name instead of keeping him at a distance and calling him by the Mr. One code name. But you can see that Daz knows what's up, and that Crocodile isn't completely healed, which is why he kind of sarcastically comments at him. And I would have to agree, but this gets so much more interesting with the more recent developments in the manga. But now, I might dive into this in the spoiler section, but for now, yeah, I think I'll leave it at that here. So the next scene, we get views around the East Blue. These were actually added in the anime that I didn't necessarily mention in the differences section. But I love the scene where Dadan and the gang all go to the old treehouse to show Ace that Luffy is all right and that Ace can finally rest in peace. And I have to say, I absolutely love this scene. Dada is such a caring and loving mother to them, and it's amazing how supportive she is of her boys. Like, it's such a like wholesome thing, and I love any scene that Dada is in now. And finally, getting back to Luffy in the present day, they talk about whether the crew managed to understand the message, but I more or less want to mention this scene for the funny jokes between the Kuji pirates, all still under the impression that all men are made of rubber and are just randomly tugging at both Rayleigh and Jinbei in addition to Luffy. And then the comment by Rayleigh that they all should probably understand the message, even though one of them seemed a little dense. And we all know who he's talking about immediately, which is what makes this so funny. And poor Zoro at the end of these episodes just can't figure it out. It takes him forever. And he knows there's more to it, but can't quite figure out what the message actually means. And I think this is spot on and just absolutely hilarious. And Perona, because his body is given up, Perona has to like hold up the newspaper to his face for like what probably is like over an hour. And her arms are like just tired. It's a funny scene. And I think that's awesome. And we see everyone else almost immediately figure it out, though. Among this, we finally get to learn what happened to Franky, and holy nightmare fuel, like, the flesh on the entire front half of his body was melted off from the blast, and we finally get to see Franky's sort of cyborg face without the skin, and my god, it's kind of funny and scary with the bulging eyes, and I did not realize until this scene just how much of Franky's body is machine, and it's basically 50-50, like, his front side is essentially all machine, and it kind of makes you wonder where his internal organs are. As well as, like, Luffy's trademark question comes to mind for me as well. Like, does Franky actually take shits? Because he doesn't really have a stomach. There's that cola refrigerator where his gut is. And it's so... where does all that other stuff go? And the last episode in this set, 513, continues to check in on many of the major players in the stories. Particularly the more of the Worst Generation. Setting the stage for where their individual stories are set to go in the new world. And additionally, we get to see Blackbeard and what he's been up to since his escapades at Marineford. And this scene is probably the most curious looking back in retrospect, because at the time, I had no idea that this scene kind of laid the seeds for a major plot point for something more than a decade and a half later down the road. And it sees Blackbeard having decimated an island, but in the process also captured one of the Worst Generation members, Jewelry Bonnie, in hopes of turning her bounty into a new ship for his crew. However, Akainu is personally tracking Blackbeard, making it so Blackbeard has to run, but leaves Bonnie behind. And the crazy thing is this short exchange between Akainu and Bonnie about how when he found out that Bonnie escaped from the world government, he had this cold chill in his body, and Bonnie yells back, "You bastards, I won't ever forgive you." And this line obviously was hinting at something. Not only does it imply that Bonnie was at some point imprisoned by the world government and she somehow escaped, and it seemed most like a throwaway line at the time that would kind of get explored hopefully at some point later, but I at the time, and probably not until recently, completely paid no mind to it. But holy cow, this exchange means so much more now that we know the full context of it. And yeah, it's nuts to think that Oda was hanging on to the fruits of the seeds that he would plant here. And especially with Bonnie's character, this episode aired in 2011, and we would not get the full context for this until 2023. And definitely file this scene away in your memory as you go. Also, to a much lesser extent, the scene with Deus Drake, because this also sets up what he's going to be doing in the new world when we catch back up to him much, much later as well. Moving on, it's interesting to see that Moria is still alive, as in the Doflamingo scene, he claims that Moria disappeared, but he was pretty much on death's doorstep, apparently. This scene always seems strange to me, because Doflamingo seems like the kind of guy that if he wanted someone dead, they'd be dead. And I remember when I was thinking about this scene when I first read it, I interpreted it as Doflamingo not necessarily helping or working with Moria, because the conversation just didn't seem like two people that had some sort of a working relationship, but more so Doflamingo, like Mihawk, just not really trying all that hard, because at the end of the day, they're annoyed at taking orders from the world government and only do it out of obligation. And they almost always do it half-heartedly with minimal effort. And in this case, I feel like it was sort of a willful incompetence on Doflamingo's part just to kind of annoy the world government and his way of sort of asserting dominance over them in small ways. But this is an amazing scene that again adds to the tapestry that is Doflamingo's intimidating, dangerous, threatening, and frankly kind of unhinged aspect to him, especially the way he giggles at the end. Like, Doflamingo's laugh is one of the more cooler laughs in the entire series. It's just so menacing. And every time he does it, he's just exuding this sort of menace like aura all over him. It's pretty wild. And finally, with Luffy's message in tow, the final scene shows Chopper deciding to return back to the Bird Island to train, research, and hone his skills. And this scene is played up for some laughs as he tries to dodge the awkwardness of returning so quickly by taking a page out of Usopp's book and creating a superhero alter ego, the Masked Chopper. And it's also seen right through, which I don't know how he would have known to do this, since he was one of the two people who didn't even know that Sogeking was Usopp. And this joke, I mean, is kind of funny, but it also kind of doesn't quite land for me as well. But what did land for me was the joke that comes later when he discovers that the tribe's people, despite their appearance, are actually very intelligent and advanced. And however, Chopper rather rudely voices this sort of insulting take on these people out loud right in front of one of them. And the reaction from the dude is just so hilarious, as he's just completely shocked at the insulting nature of this comment that Chopper is making without him even realizing it. Just thinking about it makes me chuckle a little bit, because his reaction is what really sells it, not so much Chopper's just blatant insulting comments. And then we get an incredibly sweet recollection of Chopper's flashback and the events of Drum Island, completely reanimated, I might add. And Chopper remembers how hard his life used to be and how Luffy helped him discover how much better life can be. But he also feels like he hasn't been able to do anything for Luffy when he and the others needed him the most. And probably one of the most significant moments in Chopper's character development is the fact that I love when we initially meet Chopper, he was always ashamed of being a monster and always self-conscious of this fact. And one of the more subtle moments for Chopper, if you remember back, is how when he first saw Luffy stretch against Wapo and was shocked and asked, "What is he?" And Sanji just kind of turns to him and happily replies back, "He's a monster," as a term of endearment, showcasing his absurd strength to the point where now, as a fandom, we label the three strongest members of the crew as the Monster Trio. And now Chopper's biggest fear was always being rejected by the world for his monstrous appearance, but Luffy has shown him that it doesn't matter and that it's okay to be himself. And coming full circle for Chopper, he's now ready to get past his own greatest fears and insecurities if it means that he can help Luffy and his nakama never go through something like what happened on Sabaody ever again. And of course, Chopper was probably talking mostly metaphorically about his own fears. But also, like, how could you not get excited at the prospect that he was also probably talking quite literally and hinting that he was going to train to be able to control his monster point transformation, which would be awesome to see. And now, to kind of close it off, yeah, we started on Chopper, setting him up for his journey in preparation for the new world. And on the next podcast episode, we'll be exploring the episodes that cover the other members of the Straw Hats and see where they will go in their respective journeys. But yeah, if you did enjoy this, send me a like or comment. And if you want to join me on this journey of rewatching One Piece, please consider subscribing. Check out my Instagram and Twitter account at SunnyGoPodcast for updates on when I post new episodes and see some pictures on my manga collection. As always, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to listen to my podcast. I will have a few spoiler section comments, but if you're not interested in those, stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the next episode. Bye! Okay, so spoiler section. I think the first thing I want to mention is the message that Luffy sent. Like, I can't believe I didn't put this together the first time I watched it, between the whole 3D 2Y thing, which was pretty damn obvious there. But the fact that the 16 oxbell rings, like how Killer says that in traditionally 8 is representative of a year. So 16 should automatically say 2 years. And I'm just a idiot or something, because I still did not put that together at the time, and I honestly did not realize what was happening until it was pretty much obvious to everybody that there was going to be a 2-year time skip. But I didn't put that any of that together, but I thought that was interesting, kind of looking back on these upon rewatch and seeing that, yeah, there were a lot of clues that I just completely missed. The next thing I kind of wanted to talk about is the follow-up to the whole crocodile conversation. Now, we talked about how Crocodile claims he's fully healed, but I think between the recent events that he isn't quite fully healed, because while he has gotten his sort of ambition back a little bit, he hasn't fully embraced his dream again. Because as we saw in the most recent scene with Crocodile, where with Cross Guild, Buggy rebels against both Mihawk and Crocodile and actually states his actual desire and dream to go after the One Piece again, Crocodile gets extremely frustrated. Like, Mihawk gets annoyed at that moment too, but Crocodile, like, you look at his face, he's just like, his veins are about to explode. And I think this is partly because, yeah, he's kind of rediscovered his ambition to kind of rule the seas again, but I think there's still a part of him that hasn't really embraced his original dream of becoming the Pirate King again. And we know that he still has that dream, because even after losing to Luffy, when Miss Golden Week casts the dream rainbow colors trap, the Pirate King is what shows up for Crocodile. And so it's still on his mind, even post-loss to Luffy. And so I think it really bothers him that now Buggy is trying to state his true dream. And I think where Crocodile's story eventually goes is that he will come back around to wanting to pursue the One Piece again. It'll basically be a race between the Cross Guild with Buggy and Crocodile trying to go for the One Piece. Because I think that also ties in really well with how Zoro will eventually cross paths with Mihawk again towards the end, when Zoro eventually will have to defeat Mihawk to achieve his dream. And so you have this moment where you have this epic rematch of Buggy and Crocodile versus the Straw Hats, I think is what will come down the line, because obviously we know Shanks and Blackbeard are also gunning for the One Piece as well. So you have all four Yonko basically prepping to go after the One Piece at the exact same time. And so the ending is going to be this insane sort of four-way race between them all, with probably the world government and the Marines also involved in some capacity as well. But yeah, I think kind of getting back to Crocodile, I think this moment that we see it with the Cross Guild is very indicative of the fact that he hasn't fully healed from this wounds. And I think that's what Daz is kind of getting at here, is that Crocodile, yeah, while he's trying to give off this sort of bravado that, yeah, he's fully healed and ready to go back out and do his thing, but even Daz sees that there is still something in there, because between Crocodile snapping at Jinbei about not protecting the Luffy while trying to escape Akainu, as well as just how insistent he was at trying to take on Whitebeard during a war, is also very indicative of just how much whatever happened to him in the past still affects him to this day. And of course, the last thing I kind of wanted to talk about was Bonnie and Akainu's interaction. Now, yeah, this surprised me, because I completely forgot this scene up until this rewatch as well. And it perfectly lines up with what is revealed now during Egghead, in that the fact that Bonnie was in the custody of the world government and she mysteriously escaped them, you know, on the Sorbet Kingdom Island from Alpha. And so, yeah, that part lines up. And then the fact that Akainu was also concerned about the fact that she escaped was interesting too, because I think from his perspective, he was more worried about the fact that if Kuma found out that she had escaped, then he would now be against them. But the fact that he was like, well, now it's okay, because we now have full control of Kuma. And yeah, this scene, wow. I know Oda definitely has been laying seeds with Bonnie and Kuma pretty much ever since they introduced her in Sabaody, but the fact that he had to have like this entire backstory already pre-conceptualized even at this point, and then he would just sit on this backstory for like 15 plus years until you'd actually reveal it just last year in 2023 with the Egghead Island and Kuma's backstory. I just, yeah, this is another one of those moments where I'm just like, blown away by Oda's sort of foresight and patience and his ability to cohesively write things that span so much time in real time and in the story. But yeah. Anyways, yeah, those are the things I kind of wanted to talk about. I know this episode is running rather long, so I'm going to cut it there. But I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll see you on the next episode. See ya.